Set your course for the Huff
Takes Podcast.
Welcome to Huff Takes. I'm Eric Geller.
And I'm Haley Bird Wilt.
So this is our first episode of 2026, and we're happy to be back. And this is the year that we're going to get the first Star Wars movie since The Rise of Skywalker. So we thought we'd look back at The Rise of Skywalker, or rather, what could have been with Episode 9. We're talking about Colin Trevorrow's Duel of the Fates script, and this has been much discussed. It's been circulating in fan circles for a long time, but we haven't actually covered it here on Hoth Takes just yet. And we're happy to be doing that now. And for this discussion, we're actually joined by one of Haley's friends, Jack Merritt, who I know has a lot of thoughts about Duel of the Fates. And he's actually a Hoth Takes listener as well. So, Jack Merritt, welcome to Hoth Takes. And Haley, maybe you can introduce Jack to the audience a little bit.
Jack is a friend of mine. He lives in Virginia now, but used to be in the D.C. area. He works in political communications. He has experience back in the day on Evan McMullen's 2022 U.S. Senate race. He was at the DNC in 2024 and is now an associate at Focal Point Strategy Group. And since the start of the Hoth Takes podcast, Jack has perhaps been our most loyal listener. He has often offered episode ideas. He's reached out to share his thoughts about our episodes. And now he is here to share one of the Star Wars scripts that he seems to be most excited about. So I'm looking forward to hearing why this resonated with him so much.
And Jack, like I said, welcome to the show. And we're actually just going to turn it over to you to talk us through the script. What makes this worth discussing, even, you know, almost 7 years later?
Yes. Eric, Haley, thank you both for having me. I'm really excited to be here. This is, I don't even know what to compare it to, but I have been a very loyal listener. I've been a longtime listener, first time caller. So thank you for letting me come on and talk about this little obsession of mine. I mean, you know, you said it, Eric, that it's what might have been, you know, of all sad words of tongue or pen, the saddest are these, it might have been, is what they say. And I mean, I was just encapsulated by this as soon as it came out. I think because The Rise of Skywalker was just a disappointment of like epic proportions for a lot of people, including me. I mean, its production process was a bit of a mess and it showed, it was a letdown, both as an ending for the sequel trilogy and really as the saga as a whole. But, you know, even as bad as it was, I don't think I could have imagined that, you know, just a couple months after it came out, probably when it was still in theaters, we would get, you know, this authentic concept art showing scenes from, you know, an alternate version, the original one, which was going to be written by Trevorrow. And, you know, by February, the entire script was online, which I think is completely unheard of. And what I saw in that script was a story really trying to bring a shaky flight in for a tough landing. You know, after The Last Jedi, I think the sequel trilogy was in a pretty precarious position. There's a couple paths that Lucasfilm could have taken. You know, one is to accept Rian Johnson's film, sort of embrace the, you know, monumental challenge he set before them, you know, and make something meaningful and original and add to like the overall tapestry of Star Wars. And I honestly think that's what Trevorrow tried to do with this script, but that's not really the path Lucasfilm ultimately chose. You know, rather than follow through on their own plot lines from The Last Jedi, that film really gets swept under the rug. I'm going to steal a really good analysis I saw online in a review, which compared this to the world of improvisational theater, where the most important concept is yes and. When you're doing an improv scene, in order to keep it, you know, flowing smoothly, you accept the premise that your partner lays out in front of you. And if you don't, you bring the entire scene to a screeching halt. And The Last Jedi was a plausible yes and to The Force Awakens, but The Rise of Skywalker was sort of a resounding no, actually, to The Last Jedi. And as a result, you have like this discombobulated trilogy that doesn't make any sense. I'm very much a believer in the Grace Seeger's school of thought, which says that the sequel trilogy is now simply unnecessary. It failed to justify its own existence. And, you know, looking back, The Last Jedi, which is not perfect, of course, it's the only film that really does anything remotely new or interesting. And I think that Duel of the Fates was just brave enough to follow through on everything from that film. It embraces the challenge of a dead Snoke and a Rey who's nobody. And so, you know, even if Trevorrow's script may not have been this perfect product, I mean, I think I and a lot of other people were just really impressed. I think it does a phenomenal job.
Yeah, and one of the things in reading through what's in here, you really are struck by how much like The Last Jedi, this script would have done some bold things, not just with the characters, although they're certainly that, but also with just the nature of what it means to be good or evil and what it means to try to balance the Force. I mean, good dating back to the idea of the Chosen One, fans have debated, what does it mean to have balance? Does it mean light and dark? Does it mean a little more light? Is it just light? And I think this script would have really taken a controversial approach to trying to answer that question.
I have a question for you, Jack. I wanted to ask you about something that stands out to me here. I did not have a chance to read the entire script, but I think longtime Hoth Takes listeners will know that one of the things I was most frustrated with in the episode 8 and 9 was how Finn's character was treated. He was kind of one of the very main characters of The Force Awakens and sort of gets relegated to the sidelines in The Last Jedi and kind of is just like a side character in episode 9 as it was produced. So I wanted to ask you, I see here in your notes, and again, I did not get to read the whole script, I apologize. Did he have a larger role to play in this alternative script, and can you summarize it for me? Was it good?
Yes, and it was good. I think that's one of the things it's so simple, but it really helps. In that Finn and Rose are just treated as they should be in the script as main characters, and that carries over. I think Finn may have been reduced a bit in The Last Jedi, but I mean, I think he was certainly in a large portion of that movie and had an important role. And that's just carried over. And so rather than, doing these really inexplicable things like adding, Zori Bliss and Janna and all these people who are very quickly and easily forgotten, this script focuses on these established characters, which I think is just a really good decision. It's really just respectful of them. And so Finn plays, he and Rose have this mission, this group sort of separates. And so into two or three different groups by the time it's over. And Finn and Rose go to Coruscant, which I think is really cool. And their mission involves the old Jedi Temple. And one of the main things about this story is that there's this mass communications blackout between neighboring systems. So they can't talk to each other. And the way that the Resistance is going to get around this is they're going to go to the temple on Coruscant, which is the capital, where the First Order is taken over. And it's this desolate place. But the old tech in the temple, is immune to this blackout. And so Finn and Rose go in there. They try to work around that, and so that they can broadcast this message from Leia to everybody, and to sort of galvanize people to rise up. And once they do that piece, Finn discovers this this underground sort of thing in the sewers of Coruscant, where a lot of displaced people are living, who have tried to get away from the First Order, and he rallies those people to we have to do something about this. Let's go up and let's stand up and let's take this city and this planet back. And along the way, Finn is able to make a connection with a stormtrooper that he recognizes from his time being a stormtrooper. And he plants a seed there, which later turns into that stormtrooper, turning along with a number of others. And so it all sort of builds into this climactic thing on Coruscant that Finn is a really big part of.
And that to me is probably the best part of the script, to be honest, in that it actually uses the promise of what Finn represented in that first movie, which is kind of an everyman, a person who was taken in by the system at a vulnerable point and turned into a weapon of evil, who then was able in some way to step out of that system, recognize the moral rot of the system, and work towards the betterment of all. Well, the movies kind of just leave him there. He doesn't do anything about that. He does meet another stormtrooper who left, Janna, but they don't take that idea any further. Whereas this script actually pays off the idea that Finn has this uniquely kind of insurgent populist perspective as really the only main character who is an everyman. Poe's not, Rey's not, the other rebels that we really focus on are people like Leia. He's the everyman. And this script really seems to pay off the idea that he would want to help people rise up and fight back.
Yes. Yeah, absolutely. And I think it's a natural end. It's a natural bookend when you have this guy who decides, I think it's his first battle, like, I'm not going to sit here and shoot civilians. I'm just not going to do it. And, you know, a very natural bookend is like all these other stormtroopers coming along, all these other displaced citizens coming, and, you know, he's the revolutionary leader. He's the guy like on top of the tank. I mean, it's very cool. It's really respectful to the character of Finn. It's respectful to the vision. I think Trevorrow said years before any of this, like before he was fired or anything, that he was going to try to do a really satisfying ending to everybody's story. And I think this is what that is.
And you know, the mission that we're even talking about here to Coruscant, I mean, just the fact that we're seeing Coruscant in this big set piece battle, and also as this place of like decay from the era that we remember it from in the prequels. I mean, just to see Coruscant would have been great. I remember when it first showed up in Andor and it had that caption, Capital of the Galaxy. And it really had that feeling of like, we're so back, right? Like Coruscant is getting the love that it deserves on screen after years of neglect in live action anyway. And this would have given it even a higher profile than that, which I think would have been really cool.
Jack, was there anything about this script that fell particularly flat for you that you like? Even granted, I will grant that some of this, especially Finn's role, seems much better than what we did get. Was there anything in this that would have been worse?
Well, I tell you, it's hard to be worse than The Rise of Skywalker. I'm like sympathetic to, you know, the fact that that was a really troubled production, but I mean, it's just as a film and as a Star Wars film, it's quite a product. But I do think so. There's, you know, something of a will they, won't they, can they thing with Rey and Poe that is a little jarring. And so there is something of a romance there that Rey like sort of struggles with, and you know, she tosses that over in her mind of like, can we do this? Like the old Jedi, like it was, you know, they had to be very detached. So shouldn't I do that? And you know, Poe finds that frustrating. I part of the impetus there may have been that Trevorrow saw that Rian Johnson sort of gave Finn and Rose a closer relationship in The Last Jedi. And so even though Finn is just really obsessed with Rey in the first film, maybe a little bit of the second film, I think that, you know, he made the decision, well, we're going to do something with Poe instead. I don't think it is, you know, the worst thing I've ever seen. It seems to come out of left field. And this story, I think, would have taken place some years after The Last Jedi. And so it's not really unrealistic, but I think that would have surprised people.
Can I also submit a candidate for maybe not something that falls flat, because again, we don't know what this would have looked like in the final movie, but definitely something that was kind of jarring for me, which is a big like philosophical tenet of this movie, is trying to redefine balance and redefine like how a Jedi should use the Force. In that final duel that they have in the script with Kylo, Rey essentially embraces the light and the dark and describes the balance as basically being using both of them, not denying those emotions that might be associated with the dark side, that kind of desire, love, even saying that she's not going to deny her anger. And the script seems to be making this argument that that's really balance, using the light and using the dark. And it makes me a little uncomfortable to have it, to see this script saying the true nature of balance is using both of these things, because what does using the dark side mean if not using these very evil powers that are all we see Darksiders doing? Like, I understand not denying those feelings, but taking it a step further and saying I need to actually use both sides of the Force to find balance, that strikes me as perhaps a bridge too far and kind of almost redefining the Force away from what George Lucas said, which is when you use the dark side, you inherently corrupt yourself. Like, that's where the Sith eyes come from. There's no way, you can't just do it once. It doesn't work that way. And so I guess, Jack, I'm curious what you think of the way the script tries to portray, you know, using the dark side as part of a balancing act.
Absolutely. I mean, it would have been enormously controversial. I think people would have been a little flabbergasted by this, the idea that, you know, Rey is frustrated by this concept, actually. I mean, I think she asks the same questions that you do, and she has a little dojo where she and Luke do some training in this script, which is kind of cool. But she's like, well, what is this? Honestly, like, you know, the darkness will snuff out the light, or the light, you know, overwhelms the darkness. What is this balance? And I think this is a question you guys have asked on this podcast. And so this is something that a lot of people wonder, because is it just the existence of the light? If the light side is in power, if the light side is overwhelming, is that balance? And so this, this is a fundamentally new interpretation of sort of what it means to be a Jedi, embracing both of these things. And, you know, part of it may be the idea that attachments are okay. You know, part of it is understanding and acknowledging that you have this anger. But I think the final people would have taken a lot of issue with this premise, because the implication is that, you know, you use your anger, and, you know, there, even if you have these feelings of hate, I mean, like, maybe you don't deny that either. And so it's you know, Luke in The Last Jedi sort of says something along the lines of, you know, it's hubris to think that the Jedi in its, you know, institutional way of being is the sole arbiter of the light side. And so I don't know if that is what Trevorrow was trying to follow up on, just sort of redefining entirely what it means to be a Jedi. But I mean, this certainly would have had people talking, and you know, maybe they would, maybe it, people would have really taken a lot of issue with this, but I think it would have been a huge conversation.
I mean, even recently there was a comic where we see Dooku, when he was Qui-Gon's master, basically telling him, like, it's like the Jedi are too dogmatic about, like, controlling your emotions. Like, you can let your anger out if you channel it into, like, fighting for the good of all. And the comic basically ends with Qui-Gon realizing, and later telling Obi-Wan, like, that's wrong. Like, there is no way to safely do that, to, like, channel your anger into a fight. Like, that's granted, that is not, like, the Lucasfilm position, but, like, Qui-Gon has always been the character that they use to sort of declare the most, the wisest and noblest and most astute perspective on the Force, the one that other Jedi fail to understand to their detriment. And that is where, in 2025, 2026, Lucasfilm seems to be coming down on, like, what the lessons for the Jedi should be. And that's a huge one, is that, like, there is no safe way to channel these dark emotions into a fight. And so, who knows, the road not taken, maybe this movie would have had things going in a different direction. But it is interesting to be discussing the script and this big element of it at a time where we've just seen, you know, the classic noble Jedi character used to essentially deliver the exact opposite message to Obi-Wan and to the readers. So I just thought that was interesting.
At the risk of bringing too much of the real world into that discussion, I think I do think that Rian Johnson's, like, his angle in The Last Jedi does partly come from, like, institutional distrust and his own, like, upbringing. So I don't know how much you've done reading on Rian Johnson's life as a evangelical youth group kid. But he was a youth group kid and extremely evangelical growing up, and he's talked pretty openly about this. Jack and I were just texting about the Wake Up Dead Man, which is the newest Benoit Blanc mystery, and Rian Johnson has talked again publicly about this, how it's kind of his reckoning with faith. And I do think there's, like, when we think about this, like, Star Wars and Jedi as an institution, and especially that question that Luke was asking of, like, who are we to decide what truth is? I think there is some, like, modern, like, deconstructionism. Eric, you're probably not at all in these circles that I'm in, but when evangelicals sort of, like, reconsider their positions, they call it deconstruction, and they're, like, rethinking their faith and, like, what they believe. And I do think that, like, there's a hint of that, but it's exactly the opposite of what these people actually need. Because, like, Eric, what you were saying of, like, clear moral boundaries and like, do the means, does the end justify the means, are the questions that, like, modern day evangelicals have been asking about their participation in politics. And often they have turned to, like, oh, we're just using the tools of the dark side to accomplish the goals of the light side. And it does not corrupt us at all. We are you know, the end justifies the means. So I think when you, like, give a little bit of wiggle room in terms of questioning the institution instead of, like, holding fast onto the moral principles that people theoretically should be following. Like, there's a weird reverse echo of like, that doesn't work out the way you think it should. I don't know. This, again, I'm bringing far too much modern politics into this, but Rian Johnson slightly invited it by being a former youth group kid.
Well, and Jack, one of the things I remember reading about the reaction to this script was there was a lot of disappointment with among people about how dogmatic Luke was portrayed as being, and the script sort of has Rey break from his view of the Jedi, and people were like, I don't like what this does to Luke. I don't like how this makes him seem. They're positioning him as the stodgy old way, and Rey is going to break from that. But how did you see that?
You know, I'm not entirely sure. It's an interesting way to portray him, not having grown up, of course, with any like institutional knowledge of the Jedi, and not being raised in the environment that Anakin was. That it seems an unnatural position for him to be a stodgy institutionalist, you know, his training having been, you know, running on Dagobah, not growing up in the temple. But perhaps in this instance, I mean, that just would have been a natural role for him to play. But in the prior film, of course, he is questioning everything and doubting everything and saying, I mean, I'm just going to be out here. I'm completely isolated. I don't want anything to do with this at all. And so, I wonder if this was just a really tricky balancing act. And I wonder if Trevorrow, even in trying to really honor and follow up on the plot lines of The Last Jedi, thought that, you know, with Luke's final sacrifice and with his choice to get involved at the end, you know, to do something to help the resistance escape, that maybe this was sort of the fulfillment of his arc, and he has come to appreciate the value of this stuff. And maybe that's what they're trying to weave in this last one. I mean, it's like The Last Jedi is a hard thing to follow up on, to be fair to all sides.
They should have just let Rian Johnson do it. That's my question. Why did this process end up this way?
I mean, I think we could do a whole, you know, Hollywood Reporter three-part feature series about the making of the trilogy from the macro perspective. But I would also like to know why they didn't have more of a plan. But hey, speaking of like Rey moving on from Luke, I know, Jack, one of the things that was most interesting to you about the script writ large was that there's a lot of kind of moving things forward and really evolving how things look and how we focus the story, and even just on the characters that we focus on, including, of course, there's basically no Palpatine, right? I mean, we don't pull everything back to the villain of the prequel trilogy and the original trilogy. He's got a very small hologram role, but the movie doesn't center on that kind of legacy villainy, which is just one of the ways that I know you had made a note that it's really pushing things forward.
Yes, and you know, as I said, the script, of course, I think probably this may not have even been its final version. You know, it could have used some tweaks, and I'm sure that's what they were fighting about behind the scenes. But one of its just greatest virtues, I think, is I use that improvisational metaphor of like saying yes and moving things forward and trying to do something new. I mean, when you are given the opportunity to do one of these things, I mean, very few people have done it. And I just think you would absolutely want to do your very best to do something new and original and add to this rich tapestry instead of doing something just really derivative. And so, you know, rather than I rewatched The Rise of Skywalker, and they don't say anything about putting the lightsaber back together. It just is. And I think, and they do show Kylo like gluing his mask back together, and you know, they have Palpatine back, which I think is just sort of a reaction and an undoing of Snoke's death. You know, you bring back the guy, you bring back the throne room, you do the throne room scene. The Rise of Skywalker at the end of the day doesn't really add anything, and it takes some stuff away. I mean, I think giving Rey the power to save people from death, it just brings up a lot more questions than answers. And so I do love that notion. I think, you know, Colin Trevorrow, I mean, it reads like a love letter to the saga. It reads like something that's questioning some tenets of the saga, certainly, but it's, I think he just took a really big swing and really tried to do something brand new. And it probably scared a lot of these people behind the scenes, to be honest. I mean, you know, Bob Iger in one of his books said that when George Lucas watched The Force Awakens, you know, he more or less said, well, there's nothing new here. And I think that was really the default position behind the scenes. It's like, we're going to do something. It's just going to look and feel fundamentally like Star Wars. It's going to hit a lot of these same plot points, and it's going to give, it's going to make people feel sort of the same way they feel when they watch the original trilogy. And I think Trevorrow just didn't really want to have anything to do with that.
Yeah. And he does take a lot of big swings, including one of the things that I know you wanted to talk about is the treatment of the First Order, really giving it a menace that I don't know that the sequel trilogy in its final form could really match. I have to imagine that, Haley, this would have been one of the parts of the movie that you would have disliked the most, quite how grim and dark this script would have gotten. It does really give the First Order a chance to, I don't know if shine is the right word, but he does give it a menace that I think makes it, if anything can make them worthy of being the galaxy threatening antagonists, you know, this would be it.
Jack, can you tell us, for listeners who are not familiar with the script, can you share with us some details of the menacing First Order in this version of the film?
Yes, of course. You know, this just came to me. It honestly reminds me a little bit of the Empire's portrayal in Andor, which, I mean, is taken very seriously. I mean, you know, it's easy to see them as these sort of cartoonish, incompetent villains. And Andor, like, the Empire's scary. And I think the First Order would have gotten a very similar treatment here. You know, they're treated a little cartoonishly in the Rise of Skywalker, and you know, maybe that's part of why they bring out the Final Order, which is this inexplicable fleet of 10,000 ships and all that kind of stuff. And but here, it's, you know, this is like an authoritarian government that rules with an iron fist and just like scares the crap out of everybody. I mean, they do a public execution on Coruscant. Torture is not like a new thing in Star Wars. I mean, torture has like been implicated in a number of the movies, but like they torture Rose for information, and it's like implied to be pretty brutal. And you know, upon this is not about the First Order's like might, but I mean, you know, Hux at the end of this thing like commits suicide once he sees that like the day is lost, everything's lost, and you know, the Resistance is going to win this thing. Hux takes out a lightsaber from a collection he has, and he commits suicide. And so the movie overall is like way more hardcore. But I do think, and again, like you just, there's a balance here where, you know, I think Lucasfilm or Disney just kind of, they do want these maybe to be kids' movies, but they want them to be, you know, accessible to everybody. And so this is another one of these things where it's like, I could see this fight behind the scenes of like, you know, this is a little much. it's a little scary. And so I can see why people would have had some trepidation with this, but you know, it's another one of these things where it's a big swing and it just takes it seriously.
Yeah, and I don't know how the torture would have been portrayed, but if you think about the torture scene we get in the sequels, which is in The Force Awakens, where it's Kylo using the Force on, I guess first Poe and then Rey, it's this, you know, it's sort of like torture with the edges sanded off. You know that they are being, they are experiencing anguish, and this is very difficult and painful and awful for them. But there's no physical contact. You know, it's not the like the 24 style, you know, torture. There, I mean, I guess they're maybe, I think Poe has like a bloody nose or something, right? They've been like roughed up by the stormtroopers, but it's not that kind of tactile torture that is really disturbing to watch. The doing it with the Force kind of takes the edge off a little bit because you don't have that contact. And it's clear that that is where Star Wars draws the line. Even in Andor, they chose a torture method where it's this anguished sounds of death, which is, again, chilling to think about. But in terms of that physical contact element that we're so used to from a lot of drama TV shows, they don't want to go in that direction. I don't know what form this would have taken in the final script, but it would have been very interesting if they tried with this movie to cross that line.
Right. And you know, I think the just seeing the after effects of it is what I think would have made it. Like, it's, you know, it, the script describes it just as sort of like, you know, her shirt's ripped and there's like blood and stuff. And so it's, I think it would, just would have been very uncomfortable. But, you know, I mean, they do an audio torturing of Han. I think it's in Empire Strikes Back. You know, you just hear him just yelling in the background. And so I think maybe something similar to that. I didn't mention the Knights of Ren. I mean, they, I think they're part of just sort of this very intimidating aura that the First Order has in this movie. And they do play a much bigger role. And so I think that's a part of this. There's just a brutal fight with them against, you know, Rey and Chewie and Poe. And so I think there would have been just more physical fighting in this one too. Just more violence. And so I think that too is like when you're doing something and you want it to be sort of, of course it's happy and jubilant at the end, but I mean, it takes a minute to get there. And I think that's, it's also harder when you're trying to balance these interests and make it more of a kid's movie and make sure it's something that can sell toys and things like that.
Yeah. If anybody comes out, not better, I guess, but if anybody gets an upgrade in this version of the last movie, it's the Knights of Ren. Because in The Rise of Skywalker, as we saw it, those guys were the definition of aura farming. They're standing around looking cool, building this mystique, and then basically the movie does nothing with them. And I don't remember exactly, Jack, maybe you can refresh our memories, but they do get a better role in this version of the movie.
They do. So I think, I guess, sort of the culmination of it after, you know, they make some appearances and they're pursuing people, but they, you know, when... So to table set the scene, it's Rey and Poe and Chewie, and they've docked somewhere and they're trying to get information. I think she's trying to get information about how to get to Mortis, which we can speak about later in more detail maybe. But and so the Knights are there. They have their own ship. The script gives them names, which is interesting. There's like, and the leader has the Darksaber, which is really interesting. And I think probably just a mechanism for him to fight Rey with her lightsaber. And so, you know, the fight that they have is pretty brutal. But they end up taking them all out. I mean, Chewie and Rey, like, kill them all. I mean, you know, at the end of it. And this is an instance where Rey sort of accesses that anger and anguish. I think she's scared about Poe in this instance. I think, like, that's what really triggers it. And she does, interestingly enough, she does the Force Lightning in this as well. And so she kills one of the Knights of Ren with the Force Lightning. And I think that probably scares her. But, you know, Chewie takes one out. He, like, he flings one and shoots it like a clay pigeon with his bowcast, which is a pretty interesting moment. But, it's wild. But... in The Rise of Skywalker, you mentioned it, Eric, but, like, you know, the Stormtrooper, almost speaking to us, the audience, like, says to another one, like, hey, that's the Knights of Ren. Like, here's these people that were, like, built up in the first movie, and, you know, we're cramming them in here at the last minute. You know, I think it's sort of a style of J.J. Abrams to build up a lot of things and just sort of, like, wash his hands of it and let somebody else deal with it usually. But he was forced to make this third movie and do it himself.
Yeah, and interestingly, the Knights of Ren, when you talk about that element of the script, my recollection is that we also see the Darksaber in connection with the Knights of Ren. And that kind of, when I remember, when I saw that element, I was like, this feels a little too fan servicey to me. Like, I'm not quite sure why it needs to be the Darksaber. I go back and forth between thinking that he had some grand plan to do some kind of connectivity. I mean, you even mentioned, Jack, maybe the idea is, like, you know, trying to build up towards the Mandalorian and that whole section of the lore. And then I, on the other hand, I think, well, maybe he just is a big Star Wars fan and wants to include these totems like Mortis, which we'll talk about in a second, like the Darksaber, and in ways that they don't need to be included. You know, we sometimes get frustrated, like, oh, I wish we saw more references to this, or I really wish this character had shown up here. That would have been a great place for them. I think this could be considered the flip side of that, which is, did it really need to be the Darksaber? Like, that feels almost like too small of a world to me.
Yeah, it's a good point, because that does feel a little shoehorned, to be honest. Now, but I, Colin Trevorrow may be. I think these guys are all kind of Star Wars fans, at least at a casual level. But the Darksaber, you know, I think prior to this, prior to 2019, had maybe only been seen in Clone Wars and Rebels. And so, you know, I think in all likelihood, I mean, he knew that the Mandalorian series was being made soon. And whether or not there was going to be any connection, I think it's just like this is a Mandalorian thing and like, was, and you know, would be referenced. You know, I think it's the Mandalorian season one finale is like when it comes out again. So I, my assumption is that it was just that, but it does feel a little shoehorned. I mean, you know, the Darksaber goes around to a lot of people, like a lot of, over the years, over the decades, a lot of people have access to it. But yeah, I mean, honestly, you know, I don't even know if many film audiences would have known what it is at first glance.
No, I think you're right. I mean, I think this would have been sort of like Maul in Solo, where it's like, wait, what? Like, in that case, it was like, how is he here? In this case, it would have been, why am I hearing like three people in this theater in different sections of the theater like applaud and cry and shout? Like, what am I not getting here? Because it would have been something that people would have been like, holy crap, I know what that is. And then other people would have been like, I feel like I'm missing a part of Star Wars that's actively detracting from what I'm supposed to get in this moment of the movie, which I feel like is an illustration of how not to do a tie-in, because you don't want five people in the room standing up and going, oh my God, that's amazing, and everybody else going, I feel like I'm missing out. But speaking of the Knights of Ren and their leader, Kylo Ren, he has an interesting arc in this movie where he ends in a quite different place than he does in The Rise of Skywalker. And I'd like to know, Jack, if you thought it was a better ending, because there's definitely controversy about his redemption at the end of Rise of Skywalker, but this movie takes things in a very different direction.
It does. You know, I think maybe this is the core of the story is, at least for Kylo, it's his ultimate, like, you know, power and control that he's seeking. I think you see that echoed in The Rise of Skywalker a little bit, I guess, but this one, that's really what the story is about. And, you know, this is one of the challenges that Rian Johnson left is like, well, Kylo Ren is the supreme leader now. And, you know, this script embraces that and says, well, he's going to be the villain. And Kylo's journey takes him to, you know, this creature who teaches him this new skill. And you know, eventually he gets to Mortis. But yeah, it's the ending. I mean, honestly, it's a little ambivalent. I think it's enough to where, you know, people could have had a lot of theories. I think it would have been talked about. I think people, I mean, so rather than it being a really obvious redemption with him with the blue lightsaber, with him no more armor, and you know, he and Rey get a kiss, so it's like really obvious that he's a good guy. The power he learns from this like creature is a little weird. He learns to like suck the life force out of people, and it's very like extreme, and it's like it's really crazy, and it and so he does that to Rey during like their really climactic battle. But when you know they've just about fought to the death and they're sitting there and everybody's all like bruised and beaten, you know, he decides to relinquish that and to give that back. And as he does that, you know, that's after, you know, Leia has sort of reached out in the as she does in The Rise of Skywalker, she sort of reaches out to reach him one last time. And he dies right there. But I think the very subtle implication that people could have really done theories about one way or another is that, you know, there's light in his eyes as he goes out, and that it's an act of goodwill. It's an act of light right at the end. But is that redemption? Is it enough? And so it's more ambiguous. I think people would have been frustrated by that. There's a lot of people who really like, you know, the Ben Solo character and the idea of Ben Solo. But, you know, I think people, certainly by The Rise of Skywalker, just are sort of frustrated by how in your face and obvious the redemption is.
Haley, would you have preferred a more ambiguous ending for Kylo where...
You know me. I think you both know that I'm unsubtle. on things like this. And like, maybe this would have been more artful, but I, one of the highlights of episode 9 for me is that they actually did do the redemption of Ben Solo. I like to watch a bad guy turn to the light side.
And there's probably some element of I can fix him on Rey's part too. Yeah. So, you know, we mentioned Mortis, and it does play a big role in the movie. I had just said, I think the inclusion of the Darksaber is a little bit of like, I'm a Star Wars fan myself, and I want to include this cool, shiny totem to get the fans excited. Mortis, obviously, you know, debuted in Clone Wars and still to this day has not been seen in live action. So this would have been a major kind of escalation of its centrality in Star Wars. And again, for people who hadn't seen Clone Wars, it would have been very confusing. What is this place? Why does it seem like it's like the nerve center of all life in the universe? Like, what I think it would have been very difficult to kind of shoehorn this in without having enough time to contextualize all the backstory to it. But Jack, I'd be curious to know if you thought that this was like a smooth introduction, at least as written. We don't know the final version, but did this feel natural in terms of the place in the story? Would this have been something that you could introduce without being really jarring for people who hadn't seen Clone Wars?
I think the script does enough of a good job to where you wouldn't have been completely lost. I don't think you would have been left thinking, well, there's a lot of homework here that I haven't done. I don't understand any of this. I mean, I think it sort of just introduces the idea of, you know, it's like the birthplace of the Force. It's like the start of everything. And, you know, Kylo is going there to seek this ultimate power, and, you know, Rey has to go there and stop him and face him. And so I think it's a simple enough concept, but, you know, you do always run the risk of some people feeling left out. And there was a tweet in the aftermath of the Ahsoka series, you know, that there's that sort of final shot with the villain, and he's standing with those statues, and it's, you know, it's the figures of Mortis. And that moment in the Ahsoka show is clearly meant to be really meaningful. And it's like, well, something's coming next season. It's setting something up. And there was a guy who tweeted, well, you know, Star Wars, this is one of the few times that Star Wars has left me out. I feel like I've been left out by this. I don't understand what this is. Because that show, of course, is just basically a direct sequel to Rebels. And so there is some homework required. But in this case, you know, I think you could have pulled it off. I really do. And this is another instance, to me, of this movie, you know, warts and all, or I'm sorry, the script, warts and all, being sort of a love letter to all eras of Star Wars, and doing its best to honor and embrace all of the eras. And honestly, between Mortis and Coruscant, I mean, the prequel era would have really gotten a lot of attention. And this was just before I think there was like a revitalization of love for the prequels. And it was so much so that Lucasfilm was even like forced to acknowledge it and embrace it with some of their projects that came after The Rise of Skywalker. I don't think they were quite there yet, which probably was a big hit against all of these ideas.
Yeah, I do wonder about that, how much it was like we specifically don't want to go back to these touchstones of an earlier era versus, you know, maybe in each case there were specific objections to doing these things. I mean, I think, you know, Coruscant, I would tend to agree that if you're trying to avoid Coruscant, it's hard for me to understand why, other than you don't want it to be tinged too much with that prequel lens. If you're trying to avoid Mortis, I'm a little more sympathetic, because I do think that anytime you lean on this, like, the epicenter of like true godliness in Star Wars, like the ultimate power in the universe, it's very hard to do that in a way that doesn't make other stories feel like a letdown in comparison. It's very hard to like make this feel like we can go anywhere after this, because we just went to Mortis. Like, where do you take the story after seeing the true godly power in the universe? And I do understand why they might have been reluctant to bring that back into a movie. Even as you said, if they are able to introduce the concept of Mortis in a way that doesn't leave people out, I think just using Mortis at all, period, full stop, that's very difficult to do unless you do it the way Clone Wars did it, where they basically forgot that they had ever been there.
It is difficult. I do like how weird it is, though. I would like to see them try to do this in a movie.
Yeah, I think that's maybe the best thing to be said for it, in my opinion, is that it would have brought a level of weirdness to the movies that we didn't really see a ton of. I mean, there were weird characters, I guess. There was that blob alien on the Millennium Falcon who had no limbs, and yet he was somehow pushing buttons and doing repairs. That was a weird character. But in terms of true, like, bizarro, like, settings and environments, we didn't see anything that I would actually call weird. We saw alien cultures and the, you know, Pasana, there was the dancing and whatever. That's, like, that's different, but that's not, like, weird. And I don't know if maybe that's just not in the DNA of live action Star Wars to do that kind of weird. But I guess I'd be curious to know what you guys think about the appetite or lack thereof for telling those kinds of stories in the movies.
If can I bring back my ridiculous comparison earlier? If we're like, if a little bit of the Star Wars story, just like a little bit of it, because Rian Johnson wrote one of them, is about deconstruction and religion, there should be a little bit of it later on apprehending like majesty and the strangeness of existence. So for that reason, I think it would have been very nice to, like, sure, you have issues with the institution of the Jedi, but the Force still exists, and like, and look at how strange it is, and like, how do you respond to that? Like, I don't know, just like talking to people in real life who have been through those kinds of that kind of faith journey, it's not that uncommon, and I think it would have been interesting to see in Star Wars. But again, this is a very ham-fisted modern interpretation of the Star Wars sequels. I might have to do a blog post about it.
It sounds, Haley, like George Lucas's original sequel idea, which was some weird, like, Eric, what was it? Like some sort of origin of the Force, the wills of the Force.
Yeah, the Journal of the Wills, yeah.
It was going to be really weird.
You have to elaborate. I'm not in the loop on this one either.
Oh, I don't remember the details, but Jack, I think you're right that, I mean, look, George Lucas has always been willing to embrace the fact that there's so much wackiness in this saga, and the idea of the Force just in general, I mean, it raises so many questions about how it works, and if it's a consciousness, or if it's just a phenomenon, like a you know, gravity, right? Like, what is it? There's a lot of room in there for things that we would consider to be just very weird, especially if you think about like the 1970s audience, you know, seeing that for the first time. So, I mean, I don't remember the exact, you know, story of Jack, of what you mentioned, but I do know that George was always more willing to embrace the weirdness than I think any of the people who came after him.
I agree. And I too do not remember all the details. I mean, I will say for weirdness, if we can tack one on the board for weirdness, I mean, the Rise of Skywalker, like, Exegol is bizarre. I mean, Palpatine's on a crane, and
it's disturbing though.
Well, and he has this massive audience with him, like in the, like they're a choir. They sing during certain parts, and he has you know, maybe without a government or taxation, he has fully functional and staffed 10,000 plus Star Destroyers. So that's pretty wacky. I don't know.
It doesn't move you to wonder or marveling at the miracle of existence though. So perhaps a reverse image of that is in order.
Yeah, I think that's an example of I don't know the best word to distinguish from weird, but just like bizarre, I guess. Like bizarre, I think the connotation being more like, what am I watching? Whereas like weird is like, oh my goodness, what am I watching? Like there's a little bit more positive version of it. I think for me, Exegol was like definitely different, but that's the best thing you could say about it.
It might be one of the things they executed the best about that film is, you're right, Jack, it is very strange. And like it felt claustrophobic watching it. I felt trapped in Exegol.
Yeah, they nailed the creepiness element of it for sure. Jack, I know we've covered a lot of ground, but are there any other big either story beats or like themes of the script that you want to be sure to mention, things that really stand out and kind of define, you know, what we saw here in Duel of the Fates?
I think we've covered it well, to be honest. I think we've covered the main beats well. And, you know, there's a lot that I like about it, but I think there's just a lot that could be debated. And I mean, I think this has been a good discussion of all of that. I mean, because, you know, it's I don't think it's a perfect product. I think it's something that is so different and, you know, it, norm busting and challenging. And, you know, I think it would have been, you know, far better than what we got. And I think at the end of the day, it was worth the big swing. When you put out a movie like this, I mean, it's going to make $1 billion regardless. The Rise of Skywalker made $1 billion. And, you know, I think playing it aggressive like this rather than playing it safe and closing out with this really big bang that leaves some questions, leaves some people like maybe uncomfortable or just like certainly leaves people talking, I think it would have been worth it.
Yeah, and there's a lot in here that we weren't able to cover in detail. I mean, one of the things I like is the way that Luke's ghost does kind of haunt Kylo. I think a little bit, emphasizing a little bit more the idea that, like, he was Luke's biggest failure, and I would think Luke would want to have something to say to him. And we know that that Force ghosts can appear to people and often tell them either I'm very, I'm proud, or, you got to go do this, or I'm disappointed. I mean, I think that would have been kind of cool to see, as long as it wasn't like kind of in a goofy way. But that was one thing I did want to mention before we go, because I was happy to see that part of the script. Is there like a little tidbit, something like small, where you're like, I'm glad that that was in there. I'm glad that that almost became a Star Wars movie.
Well, that's a great one. I do like, it's sort of a taunting, but it's also, I think, Luke is legitimately trying to bring him back. I mean, he's reaching out, and he continues that up until the end. And there's one thing in here that's kind of cool, and it's on Mortis, and Kylo sees a vision of himself like as a teenager at Han Solo's doorway, and I think he's leaving Han for the last time, and Han in that moment, in this flashback moment rather than this memory that we got in The Rise of Skywalker, Han is also like sort of trying to bring him back. There's a desperation in that of like, I mean, what are you doing here? Why are you dressed like this? I mean, what if we come home? And so I like that moment a lot too. And I think that is, the memory thing is interesting in Rise of Skywalker. I think that's a little bit better use of Han, showing something in the past, showing that, he and Leia were, it tore apart the whole family, but they were trying desperately to get Ben to stay.
Oh, I didn't really give my verdict on the Poe-Rey romance, but I will
now. Oh, yes, we need to hear your take on the romance elements of this.
So I did actually, I read the first like 5 pages of the script, which it's like a 150-page script. So I did not make it very far. I did not do my homework for this episode. But very early on, Poe is like hinting at how he likes Rey, and I don't like it. I don't like the vibe of it. Even though you would think I would, because I'm so into romance and Star Wars, but I'm such a loyal Rey Finn person. Like, if any story deserved to have seen its full conclusion, it is that one, because that is the story they started telling in the first film, which was good, by the way, Jack. I loved The Force Awakens. Probably I loved it so much because Rey and Finn were starting to fall in love. Who knows? Maybe that's why I enjoyed it. Anyway, yeah, maybe it's convincing, maybe not. But maybe later in the script, I would find my opinion changed. But I just it's gotta be Rey and Finn for me.
What you missed is on page 27. The Rey and Poe turn to the camera and say, "Haley, is there anything we can do to make this romance work better?" That was on page 27, so you didn't get there.
No.
All right, we're going to wrap up our discussion of Duel of the Fates right there. Jack Merritt, thank you so much for coming on Hoth Takes and talking through this script with us.
Thank you both for having me. This was a lot of fun.
And to our listeners, thank you so much for joining us for another episode. If you want to share your thoughts about this episode or suggest topics for future shows, you can email us at hothtakes@gmail.com, or you can reach out to us on X and Blue Sky. We've got links to our social media profiles in the show notes. Haley made our wonderful logo and banner art, and I edited the show and put together our music. As always, for legal reasons, we want to tell you that all Star Wars music and sound effects are the intellectual property of Lucasfilm. You can find a complete archive of past episodes of our show on our website, hothtakes.wordpress.com. And if you like the show, please share it with a friend. You can find Hoth Takes on all the major podcasting platforms, including Apple Podcasts, Amazon Music, and Spotify. We'll see you next time. May the Force be with you.